You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hey, listeners, and welcome back to National Security Law Today. Last week, we began our conversation with Dr. Jeff Waxman, Program Manager at the Department of Defense's Strategic Capabilities Office, to explore how microreactors, like those being developed through Project Pele, are reframing the nuclear energy conversation. This week, we turn to the deeper questions surrounding nuclear, that being its safety and public perception. In today's episode, Alisa and Dr. Waxman unpack the historical baggage of nuclear fear, the evolving policy landscape, and what it will take to rebuild trust in nuclear. As always, thanks for tuning in, and here's Alisa.
I want you to talk a little bit about moving this thing, because you talk about, you know, you can put it on an airplane, you can put it on a train. I had a very strong reaction to what happened in Palestine when the train suddenly offloaded a toxin in another small community.
You mean Palestine, really, Ohio, right? Just to be clear for listeners.
In OH. So that was a bad thing. So you're putting these things on God knows what. You're driving between states. And, you know, anybody who's been to law school knows even the mud flaps on the truck, you know, might be differently regulated under the Commerce Clause. Here we're talking about potentially serious nuclear material. I don't, how on earth can you get away with moving this stuff all over the place?
This might terrify you, or you might be comforted to know that on any given day in the United States, there are something like 10,000 radioactive shipments that happen. Now, some of them are to move fuel for nuclear reactors, but actually the bulk of them, the vast majority, are radiologic sources for hospitals. The sources that are used for cancer treatments and things like that typically have half-lives of like 3 days. And so they have to be constantly remade and reshipped. So they're constantly on the road. And the reality is that no one in the United States in its history has ever been harmed by radiation from nuclear shipment. And the reason is what I mentioned earlier, which is the zero tolerance for failure. So you say, well, okay, well, what happens if this nuclear material is on the back of a truck and the truck slips off a bridge and falls 30 feet into a lake or hits a boulder? Well, the casket's in has to withstand that. When you move nuclear waste, it has to be able to withstand a 30-foot fall onto a point. It has to be able to withstand a fire. It has to be able to withstand a flood. It has to be able to withstand getting hit by a train. There's video online of a nuclear cask on a train track getting hit by a train, and it's the train that breaks. It's extraordinary resilient stuff. I remember when the boat hit the bridge in Baltimore last year. Remember that happened and took the bridge down?
How could I forget? I think I had a doctor's appointment for my kid the next day.
People were like, well, why can't you make the bridge such that it could withstand a boat strike? Because surely this would happen occasionally. And the answer was, well, you could make the bridges resilient to boat strike, but that would be really expensive. So no one wants to do it. And I was like, boy, if only that's not how we think in nuclear. We think, well, if a boat could hit it, then you have to be able to withstand a boat. So these casks and shipments are just extraordinarily resilient. So obviously we're not looking again to car crashes, but you can definitely withstand that. What happened in Palestine, Ohio is because those chemicals are not shipped with the same level of fear, even though they should. I like to bring up the Bhopal chemical accident. Have you ever heard of that one in India?
I have actually. You want to talk a little bit about what that
was? So it was a Union Carbide plant in India that was making insecticide, and they had a failure, and a bunch of this poisonous insecticide got out, and it killed about 10 times as many people as died in Chernobyl from nuclear. Now, you've heard of it, but most people haven't. And most people, they will happily go to the store and buy insecticide and spray it on their lawn and not think about how toxic this stuff is. But nuclear, we have the standard of zero tolerance. We cannot accept these failures. Obviously, the one exception was Chernobyl, and that's really more to Soviet incompetence and deceit. Certainly, you know, there's that HBO show that gets into that. But other than Chernobyl, there has never been a casualty due to civilian nuclear, and it's because the safety standards are so extraordinarily high, and they should stay that way. I think the zero tolerance is a good thing.
So, but closing the loop on that, I guess the safety standards are what make it possible to move across states, because if you didn't have that, obviously that would be a problem. You know, I don't necessarily want to get into it in this, but one of the issues when we were talking about things like bringing a chip fab online was the need for things like seismic stability. And one of the things that always blew my mind when I was going on these long bike rides up and down the California coastline was how many times I would go by a nuclear power facility of some kind, obviously one right there on the ocean in this area of zero seismic stability. You know, the thing is, you can move these things away from those threats, I imagine. Not that we always know when earthquakes are coming, but we could in the future.
Yeah, I mean, we don't assume that. We assume that it has to handle the weather in that area. So we're set up in Idaho. We're going to be set up for a prototype. We have to handle the hottest temperature in the history of Earth, the coldest temperature in the history of Earth. We have to withstand earthquakes. I mean, that is earthquake country in Idaho. It's just a two-hour drive from Yellowstone. So you do have to withstand that. And nuclear buildings have to be earthquake proof. That's actually, by the way, I wasn't going to bring this up, but when I talk about regulatory reform for these small reactors, earthquakes is actually one of those areas because traditional nuclear reactors have to be in earthquake proof buildings. So no matter what earthquake hits, that building has to withstand it. Well, building buildings to that level of stability is very expensive. And so for microreactors, we have argued that actually you don't need to be in an earthquake proof building. What we have demonstrated with our safety case is that if an earthquake happens, things might fall over and a wall might fall down, but we will not have any sort of dangerous release. So that is kind of a new way to think about nuclear regulations. It allows you to bring your costs down, but still without any risk to the public. And that kind of delicate dance about what are the regulations that we could ease while still being able to demonstrate satisfactorily to the regulators that we're not going to cause any harm to the general population. This is part of the conversation that has to happen as we figure out how we're going to regulate these advanced reactors if they're going to come online on the grid in the United States.
But when we look at Fukushima, I mean, what happened there? Wasn't there nuclear material released or was there not?
Yes and no. There was nuclear material released, although not enough to actually harm anybody. But there were two unique things about Fukushima that are different than the way we do things in the United States. The first is that the United States requires you to have backup infrastructure that can be available no matter what happens. And the Japanese did not. So all of their backup power generators all got flooded out and broke when the tsunami happened. So they didn't have backup power on site, which you would have at a U.S. reactor. The bigger issue was actually a cultural issue, namely that in the United States, whoever's in charge of safety at a reactor is king, makes any decisions that they want for safety purposes. And at Fukushima, that was actually not the way it worked. The head of safety at the reactor was overruled by politicians. The radiation that escaped was because radioactive gas was building up inside the containment vessel. And the safety guy said, well, hey, you could release a little bit of this gas and then it'll relieve the pressure. And it's not enough radiation to harm anybody. And the government said, no, we don't want to have any release of radioactive gas, and overruled them. And then the gas pressure built up enough that it actually exploded and let a whole lot more than would have happened if they had listened to the safety guy. At a more fundamental level, this is why we're trying to move to what we call passively safe reactors. So as we look at the next generation of nuclear, so Pele and things like that, it will be passively safe. So what this means is, again, going back to Fukushima, is that traditional nuclear reactors had redundant safety. They said, hey, if this breaks, here's the backup. And if the backup breaks, here's the backup to the backup. And here's the backup to the backup to the backup. But at some point, something has to work and do something. And so Fukushima had a combination of an earthquake and a tsunami and some bad planning and a bad political decision. And that led to something actually breaking and causing a release. So as we move to passively safe reactors, what that means is that there actually requires no action. I don't require flowing water. I don't require electricity. I don't require anyone to take any action for this reactor to turn off safely. We don't have any reactors like that operating in the United States. The Chinese do. But Pele and other reactors like it will be able to bring this sort of passive safety nuclear. And I think that is a message to the public that says, hey, you understand that a Fukushima incident is very unlikely, but it's not impossible. Well, we're taking you to a world where a Fukushima-like incident can't even happen.
Okay, but you did mention China right now. Mm-hmm. And of course, now I'm going to want to ask you about China. Are they better at this? Is there anything that they are doing that we should admire? And I'm talking about information only that is, you know, available to the public here. But, you know, we're a competitor of China in so many other regards that it certainly begs the question of whether or not this is an area in which we can compete. Obviously, we can't on things like certain critical minerals, which only exist within their confines. But this, obviously, because we're in an AI battle, it begs the question whether or not they can handle the nuclear.
You know, I mentioned earlier that in the last 47 years, the U.S. had built two non-naval nuclear reactors from scratch. In comparison, China has 28 under construction right now, and they produce about 5 per year. And it's not that their designs are better. In fact, their leading design is an American design that they stole from Westinghouse. But what the Chinese can do on nuclear, just like the way they do on trains and bridges and roads, is they are just much better right now at building large things. at being able to forge large pieces of steel, they are able to take the same design that we have here and they can build it for a third the cost in China. And so there's been a big push the last few years. This has been a big bipartisan push in Washington to say, well, how do we get back to the point that we can build things in America, how to build big things? Now, the Chinese have also been pushing ahead with advanced reactors. So while they're primarily building these this traditional Westinghouse design, they've also been pushing forward on these passively safe reactors, on TRISO-based reactors. And they turned on the first generation 4 nuclear reactor in world history. It was called HTRPM. It turned on about 2 years ago. And they're building more of them. So they're trying to move to these more advanced reactors as well. But still, it's not that they have better technology than us. It's just that they can build it faster and cheaper than we can.
Then I think we need to get over that and be able to compete. That's not great to hear, actually. That's alarming. So we've talked a little bit about the bipartisan aspect of nuclear. Now, I have noticed that a lot of center-left environmental groups are now advocating for a transition that incorporates more nuclear in the interests of slowing climate change. I guess I wonder whether or not that's actually touching you in any way as I see this. I mean, we're talking about, I say center-left environmental groups. I mean, they were far-left environmental groups sort of moved to the center on this topic. Is that aiding you in any way at this point? And could it be of benefit to some of these other strategies to produce things more quickly in the interest of competing with China?
Yeah, I mean, I've been before a Senate committee twice, once at a public hearing and once at a closed door hearing. And both times, literally every senator on the panel from both parties wanted to see nuclear happen. So it's become extraordinarily bipartisan. I do think one of the things that's really motivated people on nuclear has been seeing the way that we lost the battle on rare earths, on solar panels, and on computer chips. And recognizing that, you know, hey, if we want to become the world leader in producing batteries, like that's decades away. We are so far behind in that challenge. In terms of computer chips, you're probably aware of the CHIPS Act that was passed a few years ago to try to bring computer chips back. And I heard multiple senators have said things along the lines of, we don't want to have happen to nuclear what happened with chips. And we want to make sure that we act before this becomes a critical challenge, while the U.S. still is the world leader in technology in terms of nuclear and still really has the leading expertise. So let's act now and bring this clean power on. Like I said, I think there's very, very few holdouts at this point. It's beyond just what we would generally call like the center left. I mean, you've seen even California reverse the shutdown of Diablo Canyon. New York has also, Illinois have both passed bills recently to try to bring nuclear back online. So I think it's awfully broad at this point, the support for nuclear.
Well, I hope so. But let's move on to the practical uses of nuclear right now, because part of our conversation is obviously prompted by the need for greater data centers, data being what feeds the AI models. Do you think nuclear can address the need for energy that is presented by AI? Can it scale? And what would be the limitations of nuclear in terms of supporting those burgeoning day-to-day needs?
The answer long-term is yes. The answer short-term is, unfortunately, that's going to be mostly gas that's going to meet those data center needs. But my hope is that over time that transitions to nuclear. One of the big advantages that nuclear has for data centers is its reliability. So there's a term called the capacity factor, which says for any given form of electricity, if it has a certain maximum power that it could put out, and you average up over the entire calendar year, what percentage of the time were you getting what it says on the tin? And for a fossil fuel plant, it's often maybe 60%. Solar and wind are typically around 20%. And nuclear is 93%. It's staggeringly high. So that sort of reliability just allows it to be used for something like this. Another really key aspect here, which people sometimes downplay, is heat. So we focus a lot in terms of getting off fossil fuel on electricity, but forget that electricity is only about 1/3 of the energy that we use as a country. The other 2/3 is other things, heat, transportation, et cetera. Particularly, you think about the high temperature process heat that you need for certain industrial processes, whether it's to make fertilizer or other industrial chemicals. That heat has to come from somewhere. And right now, for the most part, it comes from gas and coal. But nuclear has the ability to do that. My Pele reactor puts out exhaust heat on order of magnitude 500 degrees Celsius. You could do a lot of really interesting things with our waste heat. And so I think we should be thinking more about the non-electrical parts of the grid. I'd like to point out, well, not like to, because it's kind of depressing, but if you look at where all Earth's energy has come from, over the last 20 years, the percentage that has come from fossil fuels has dropped from 84% over the last 20 years to 82%. That is all the success that we have had with all of the climate efforts that have happened around the world, all the money in solar and wind. And it's because, yes, solar and wind have become a larger part of the electric grid. They're something like 10% of the US electric grid, but they cannot provide what you need for industrial process heat, district heating, things like that. That is all still fossil fuel. So that's one of the big advantages of nuclear, is that it's not just electricity. It's also all the other things that you could get from it.
I wonder if you have an opinion, sort of circling back to the needs of AI here, about whether or not these mobile reactors could be used with any consistency. Because if I've heard you correctly, we have to take these things offline. And I don't know that we can do that with data centers. They need a constant source of power. Mm-hmm. Can you just briefly touch on that?
Yeah. You know, that's a good point. So to be clear, like, these small, really transportable reactors are not going to be providing the bulk of the power to data centers. If I'm OpenAI or Amazon or Google, I need gigawatts of power. So those are going to have to be larger nuclear reactors to provide that. But yes, you never want to be reliant on one of anything, because any system is going to have to go down for maintenance or it could break, right? So the way I would visualize it is, let's say I needed a gigawatt of power. I wouldn't want to power that with a gigawatt of one nuclear reactor. You'd probably want to have like a dozen 100-megawatt reactors. And then that way, one or two of them can go offline and you still have all the reliable power that you need. And then you can have confidence that if I have 12 nuclear reactors at any given time, I can count on 10 of them, no matter what happens. So that would be the way you would do it. And so if you look at what companies like Amazon and Google have been doing in the last couple of years, they have not been targeting the gigawatt nuclear power plants. They've been targeting stuff that's more in the 100-megawatt range. So Amazon did a deal with X-Energy. Google did one with Kairos. And they're all kind of looking at that sweet spot of somewhere between 50 to 100 megawatts per unit, and then having a bunch of units at the same location to be able to have that reliability in case one or two of them have to go down.
Let me ask you this. What do we need to develop next in order to exceed our capacity at present?
What we need to do as a country in the United States is to really commit to say, we're going to make nuclear happen and we're going to take it really seriously. So this is what we did with chips, right? When we said, hey, we want to bring chip fabs back to the United States, we didn't just pass like, this is the policy of the United States, or try to tweak a regulation. No, we said, here's like $20 billion, right? Go make this happen. And that was enough money to make Intel and TSMC and those other companies go and actually invest money to make this happen. And I think the same is going to be true in nuclear. I don't think that a regulation change is going to be enough to make nuclear reactors happen. We're going to have to say, you know what? Here's $5 billion, and we're going to invest this to make nuclear happen. Now, that has already happened to some extent. If you look at what was passed in the Inflation Reduction Act a couple of years ago, there were several billion dollars in there to facilitate different parts of the nuclear supply chain. Some of it was to try to get uranium enrichment going. Some of it was to fund a couple of reactor demos and different things in there. But I think we need to do more, because there's no technology that has more of a first mover disadvantage than nuclear. We talk to utilities and various companies. Everyone wants to buy the fourth reactor. No one wants to buy the first one. And so government just has to buy down that risk, get a few of these reactors built, build them in a smart and strategic way, so that once you've built a few, the commercial sector will then be able to pick you up from there. And then you'll be able to drop those subsidies away. But I think it's going to require a significant and concerted investment by the federal government for us to really compete with countries like China, again, on nuclear.
And, you know, part of your answer prompts me to, and I didn't ask you this earlier, but I should have, which is, where do we get uranium? Where is it? And who are we depending on for that? And I failed to ask you that, but I think it's an important part of this conversation, since it's a national security podcast.
Sure. So uranium is actually pretty much everywhere. If you have a granite countertop in your house, you have some uranium. But the tricky part is actually not the uranium. It is the uranium enrichment. So the United States stopped enriching uranium more than 30 years ago, because the Manhattan Project had made so much that there was just way too much of it. And so there were stockpiles for like the Naval Reactors Program for the next 60, 70 years. They didn't need any. For the commercial sector, we were happy buying our enriched uranium, about half of it, from Russia. And that suddenly became a problem when Russia invaded Ukraine. And what is fascinating, which a lot of people, this is not classified or anything, this is public information, but is not widely known, that when we cut off the United States from buying Russian energy, we specifically exempted uranium. And what's particularly fascinating is that if the Russians just said, screw it, we're not going to sell you any uranium, they could have really crippled the US electric grid. But they have continued to sell uranium to us throughout this entire war, because they need U.S. cash so bad. And so we are continuing to do this process of buying enriched uranium from Russia. Now, everyone recognizes that this is a problem, and that's why Congress, like I said, has passed some money to restart uranium enrichment in the United States, but that is still years off. They're trying to have that turn on by 2028, and realistically, that's probably an optimistic date for when we'll actually have uranium enrichment again in the U.S.
Wow, these are long timetables for a lot of what we're discussing. That's not necessarily comforting, but from your perspective as a scientist, physicist, what should national security lawyers be thinking about over the next decade when it comes to nuclear energy? Because I do think this is something that they're going to have to consider. And I think anybody working in the space is going to have to also understand national security.
You know, I joke with our attorney that I've become like a de facto 1L from just doing this job. There's so many laws involving nuclear. I'd say the two areas that most often come up, one is just the non-proliferation issues around nuclear, right? So much of nuclear policy is built around not letting other countries be able to generate their own nuclear technology because we're worried that things will be diverted to nuclear weapon technology. Because a lot of nuclear weapon technology, nuclear energy technology use similar equipment, to say the least. The other area comes down to obligation, basically foreign implications of the supply chain. So right now for nuclear power, for either the nuclear weapons program or the nuclear Navy program, or what we do for Pele, everything has to be what we call U.S. flagged. We can't be using stuff that is made in other places. We have to enrich our own uranium. Every component inside those enrichment plants has to be made by a U.S. company. Well, that drives up costs. And this conversation has started, well, should we be willing to let other countries or allies, you know, whether it's England or whoever, countries that or France that can do this, to be willing to give a little bit in those areas and be willing to kind of have this be like a Western world partnership of clean nuclear power? Now, that's a really tricky thing I'm wading into. So I just want to like double emphasize here. I'm not speaking for the Department of Defense here. This is just Jeff as a private citizen just throwing ideas out, trial balloons out. But these are sort of stuff that, you know, I can hear the NNSA and State Department lawyers already getting spun up from hearing me from a distance talking about this stuff. But this is stuff that is complicated. There's a lot of history behind all these nuclear laws. A lot of stuff was done in the 50s, a lot of policy that was set by Eisenhower and Kennedy. And so we really just have to think as we move forward, what is the most efficient way? And I know you're, you know, you go, oh, timelines like 2028 and 2030 sound like far away, but for nuclear, that's like warp speed. And so if we want to be able to move on even decade timelines, we have to start thinking about what are the flexibility, what are our options that we have to move a little bit faster. And so a lot of this requires a lot of lawyers. And so there's definitely a lot of room for them.
Yeah, well, I hope that there is somebody imagining what that salon of thought makers, you know, what they would do if they were trying to advance this along, because I think one of the big problems in the government is you have everybody with all these disparate interests, and somebody needs to look at this from a holistic perspective. And it sounds like you do, but hopefully we can see the emergence of somebody who's really spearheading this or some entity that's spearheading this. Although I think we're shrinking government right now and not the other way around.
Well, this is a National Security Council thing, is that the NSC is going to have to basically wind up either principals or deputies and lay out options and make decisions. I'm just a Mongo pawn and game of life GS-15 over here. I don't make these decisions for the United States. So this is something that the NSC can do. They can pull in State Department, NNSA, DOE, everybody, and just talk about what the options are and make some decisions.
Yeah. And sometimes when they close the door to those rooms and it gets really hot, they can make decisions. It happens quicker. Or if you give everybody coffee, you know, and they need that break. There are all sorts of strategies here, many of which Johnson used when he was president. All right. Well, you've been an absolute delight. I really enjoyed talking to you. We hope in the future, as things unfold, that you might come back and talk to us a little bit more.
Sure. I'd be happy to. You know, I enjoy talking, as weird as it sounds, to talk legal issues, but it's become so much osmosis of legal stuff. I think it's very interesting and sexy, so I'm happy to talk about it. It was enjoyable. And you asked very good questions. I appreciate it.
It's more accessible than fusion. I'm just putting it out there. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Our guest tonight has been Dr. Jeff Waxman. Jeff is a program manager at the Strategic Capabilities Office, where he leads Project Pele, named for a goddess in Hawaii, not the Brazilian football/soccer player of note. It's a mobile nuclear reactor project and Project TRISO, T-R-I-S-O, In addition to direct program management, he aids coordination of the nuclear energy programs and related policy development across the interagency, which sounds like the NSC to me. But before arriving at SCO, he worked at NASA as a senior policy advisor, where he advised on policy and technical issues while also serving as the first executive secretary / designated federal officer of the National Space Council Users Advisory Group. The rest of his bio will be linked in the notes to this cast. Now, to our listeners, thank you so much for listening to NSLT. Be sure to share this episode with a friend. Remember to subscribe. It will help us. Like this episode. Do whatever you can. There's an algorithm that's triggered by your support. We try to bring long-form, substantive podcasts to you that are nonpartisan, and we do that at no cost to the listener. So please give us a little love, if you will, online. We would really appreciate it. Remember, as you listen to these podcasts, particularly a lot of our younger lawyers, listen to all this with a view of what the future might look like and where you might fit in. Sometimes what the world looks like in a moment and what you latch onto in a moment may not be where you would be most needed. So keep your mind open. I know a lot of you are struggling right now because you feel that there has been an evaporation of available federal jobs. But in the fullness of time, if you find the right spot, there's always going to be a job for you. I want you to remain optimistic, and maybe this podcast will give you some ideas you never had before. And by the way, that sound in the background, yes, is a 100-pound dog that wants to be fed, and so I apologize. Our writer, producer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity and in no other way. Not only am I here in my individual capacity, but of course, so is Jeff. He does not speak for the Department of Defense. Our editor, my co-producer, is Francis Burkham, who does not live in Palestine, but is in Ohio. My other co-producer is Holly McMahon, who is just incredible, here with a cold, still juggling plates. And really importantly, I am also supported by all of the members of the Bipartisan Standing Committee on Law and National Security. These are the big brains in Washington. They may not have a PhD in fusion, but they're smart enough to listen to people who do. Just remember, without them, this podcast would not be possible.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.